Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very distinguished speaker, Frances Beinecke. Ms. Beinecke is the president of Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, one of the nation's most influential environmental action groups, which uses law, science, and the support of 1.2 million members, including me, and online activists to ensure a safe and healthy environment for all living things. Under Ms. Beinecke's leadership, the organization has launched a new strategic campaign that sharply focuses NRDC's efforts on solving today's environmental problems, including curbing global warming, stemming the tide of toxic chemicals, and accelerating the greening of China. Ms. Beinecke has worked with NRDC for more than 30 years, during which time NRDC's membership has doubled. Ms. Beinecke received her bachelor's degree from Yale College and a master's degree from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. She has received several awards, most recently the Rachel Carson Award from the National Audubon Society. Please join me in welcoming Frances Beinecke.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you. I want to thank you all for coming. This is a great opportunity for me to share with you some of the things that NRDC is working on and really making a priority right now. I want to especially thank Ann Clark, one of NRDC's longtime members, who helped arrange the program today. It's truly a privilege to be here because the Commonwealth Club has a long and rich history in focusing on civic issues in here in San Francisco and around the nation. And in fact, back in 1913, the Commonwealth Club commissioned a study on air pollution. So I think that really shows you how long and deep the commitment is, and I really appreciate that ongoing commitment to restoring planet Earth, which has to drive so much of what we do. We need that vision and commitment more than ever today. Our planet is facing sweeping ecological changes. I'm sure you read about it all the time. At NRDC, our primary focus right now is finding solutions to the biggest challenges facing the ecology of the planet. You know that I am a president. I'm the president of NRDC. We're an environmental organization with a long and rich history, 40 years old. But increasingly, I'm spending more time with corporate leaders, with the business community, as well as with our own advocates and grassroots. And why have I found myself in so many boardrooms more and more? Because global warming is the number one issue that we're facing at this time. And we need all sectors, not just the environmental sector, to take leadership in this critically important issue. And the business community has to be a partner in this, and there can be a very potent ally. In order to tackle all the issues that NRDC cares so deeply about, from protecting wildlife and wild places, to reviving our oceans, to putting China on a greener pathway, we must first combat global warming. I travel on the front lines of this crisis every day, and I meet with lawmakers and advocates and business leaders. And I want to tell you that I'm beginning to see a transformation taking place across all sectors. Momentum is really beginning to build to solve this issue. And it's coming from some unexpected sources. As I mentioned, the business sector, tremendous advances in science and technology. Government is beginning to take action, particularly on the state level, but also beginning at the federal level. Today, I'm going to concentrate on what's happening in the business world and the implications that this will have for our economy. Everybody in this room, I'm sure, is well aware of what's happening with global warming. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into the details, but I do want to emphasize where the science on this issue is taking us. Over the last year, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, sponsored by the UN, issued three critical reports assessing where the science is on this issue. Their conclusions are powerful and unequivocal. First, that humans are causing this problem. Second, that global warming pollution comes from three primary sources: the power sector, primarily coal combustion, the transportation sector, and deforestation around the world. And third, the on-the-ground impacts are occurring at a much faster rate than any of the earlier models predicted. I think many of you are probably aware that the Arctic is ground zero for global warming. Predictions for the Arctic summer sea ice are opening up, no sea ice in the summer, are now as soon as 2017. Just a year ago, those predictions were for 2040. Every time new information comes out, it's more astonishing than what we heard literally just months ago. And if there is an important message that this tells us, it is that we have to get this right and soon, that we're running out of time. Recently, the head of the IPCC, Dr. Pachauri, who received the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the IPCC, said, "If there's no action before 2012, that's too late. What we do in the next 2 or 3 years will determine our future." That puts tremendous pressure on all of us to work as hard as we can to solve this problem. But in my point of view, this is not the time to dismay, because solutions do exist right now that can avert this urgent threat. And at the same time, we think that they can be a powerful engine to the economy. Our environmental challenge is quickly emerging as an engine of growth and opportunity. But if we don't act, the economic downside will be devastating as well. We need to take concrete steps as a nation to ensure that the new technology and business innovation that's out there begins to truly reduce the emission reductions that we so desperately need. And just to put it in context, scientists are calling for an 80% reduction of carbon emissions by 2050. We have to get at this right now in order to meet that very bold target. Cynics say that these are luxuries. In fact, what we're talking about is an investment in our future, in the future of the planet, that will pay huge dividends for the planet and our ecological well-being, and has to play dividends for the economy as well worldwide. Today's serious challenges make these even more important to put in place. 2007 was the year that the business pages turned green, every magazine turned green. It seems as though the world turned green. Everybody wanted to get into the act. I'm sure you all noticed that in basically every publication, every ad that you saw. Companies from well-known leaders like Whole Foods and Toyota to historical laggards like General Motors and ExxonMobil, everyone was touting their plans for a green future. There's no question that there's a lot of hype out there. But underneath it all, I do think that there begins to be a fundamental change in how people are thinking about these issues. Fundamental in a way that I haven't seen since the environmental movement started 40 years ago. There's tremendous commitment, enthusiasm, and interest in getting this right. And we have to grab hold on that. For generations, American industry has considered the environment as a cost of doing business. Now we're beginning to see a generation of leaders who understand that the environment is an opportunity to grow their business, that solving environmental problems can bring profits, not just pain and increased costs. That idea is very much at the center of a lot of NRDC's work today. It used to be that the only time NRDC came face-to-face with most companies was in the courtroom, and those of you who know us well know that that's one of our primary skills, and we use it very, very powerfully. But today, we're just as likely to achieve our success in the boardroom. And in fact, we're in both places all the time, and that kind of broad advocacy where we can make change is critically important and at the center of what NRDC does. More than 200 years ago, Adam Smith, the founding father of economics, described the power of markets as the invisible hand. Today, we are proving that that invisible hand can also have a green thumb. The profit motive is an incredibly powerful force for change. We have to be sure that it's designed to benefit the environment as well, and that's what we're focusing on. Global warming, in particular, is driving tremendous change in the competitive landscape across America. Those changes, in turn, are having an important impact on the political landscape, where change has to happen. In the last 12 months, NRDC has been at the center of some remarkable developments with the business community. We worked side by side with the Texas Pacific Group and other private equity firms behind the $44 billion buyout of TXU, the giant Texas utility. TXU is now being transformed into one of the worst climate offenders to one of the leaders in the field, thanks to an unprecedented set of commitments that NRDC helped to design. And this was not an act of charity on their parts. They could have been an NRDC member for just a few bucks. But the buyers called us into the deal, as well as others, because they saw a strategy on global warming as a crucial part to their core business plan, and they wanted to get it right. They agreed to scrap plans for 8 new coal-burning power plants and to invest $400 million in new initiatives to save money and promote efficiency, which would reduce their electric load so that such plants weren't needed in the first place, thus saving prodigious amounts of carbon emissions, which is, of course, why we were there in the first place, to make sure that happened. Wall Street had never seen anything like this before, and Washington hadn't either. It was around the same time that I was in Washington, D.C., standing side by side with the CEOs of General Electric, Alcoa, DuPont, PG&E, and a host of other companies, launching the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. That alliance of now nearly 30 companies and over half a dozen environmental organizations is calling on Congress to pass a concrete limit on emissions, along with a market system that rewards smart companies for quick, decisive action. U.S. CAP is part of the growing pressure on Congress and the next president to deliver an effective solution to climate change. They're at the table, many of them, because they see a tremendous opportunity here. But others are there because they see the handwriting on the wall. As one CEO said, if we're not at the table, we're on the menu. They want to be part of the conversation. They know where this is heading, and they want to sort it out as quickly as possible so each of these companies can have maximum competitive advantage. It's getting ahead of the competition at home and abroad and knowing what the rules of the road are so they can begin to make the long-term investments that are going to carry their business forward. Today, we're seeing more and more companies standing out on global warming solutions. Over 25 states have begun to take action to reduce their own emissions. The Supreme Court has told EPA that it has to start regulating climate pollution. The question today isn't whether America is going to take steps on this crucial issue. It's a question of when and how, and whether the steps are adequate to really avert the serious problem that lies ahead. The message to Washington could not be clearer. We've had enough of politics. It's time to get down to business. And, of course, that's what we're focused on, getting results. So how do we get there, and what's it going to cost? And I think that this year the issue is all going to be, what are the economics of this? Most of you know McKinsey & Company. It's one of the most powerful global management firms in the world and advises companies all the time on what's coming down the road, what's ahead, what do they have to address. In December, McKinsey released a year-long study on greenhouse gas abatement intended to answer this very question of what are the costs going to be. NRDC was one of the co-sponsors of this study. It's one of the most thoroughly comprehensive works of this kind. Using the most detailed analysis available, McKinsey ran 250 different scenarios on global warming solutions. The results confirm that we can still achieve the emissions reductions that scientists say we need. That's 80% by 2050. And that we can do it, and this was the surprising thing, I think, to many who saw the report, we can do it at little or no net cost to the economy if, and this is very important, if we get going now. They really showed the benefits for early action, and that's a story that we want widely told. Everything on McKinsey's list is based on technologies that we have in hand today. Nothing needs to be invented. There are no magic wands. And the power of that, of course, is that a lot more things will be invented in the years ahead. So if we start now, we know there's going to be more opportunities than even they were able to identify. The missing link that they said is not the technology, but the policy. And, of course, that's where NRDC comes in because we work on policy all the time. The policy to move cleaner, new efficient solutions off the shelves, out of the labs, and into the marketplace. And that, in my view, is largely a feature of political will. We have to get political leaders to move these policies forward that will unleash these opportunities. McKinsey identified three things that need to happen. First, we need to set an enforceable limit on carbon emissions, essentially put a price on carbon. Second, we need to make large-scale investments in these technologies so it will drive down the cost and actually get them into the marketplace. And those include things from new solar panels to the technology that will take carbon out of coal when it's being combusted in power plants. Third is to set new performance standards to allow utilities to work profitably with businesses and homeowners so they can invest in the massive opportunities for energy efficiency that are out there, basically to get the rules right. Some people have likened this to the Apollo program. I think it is more akin to the rise of the Internet or even the Industrial Revolution. What we're talking about is a major transformation in the energy sector, absolutely transformative, fundamental from beginning to end. That's the way a lot of venture capitalists see it. Of course, many out here in Silicon Valley, the Vinod Khoslas of the world, John Doerr, others. As John Doerr said recently, energy is the largest economic opportunity of the 21st century. And this is his business. He should know. The United States can lead this race, or it can follow. And I think you will agree that the United States must be a leader and must be at the head of the pack. And it's going to take a lot of work to get us there because we're not there now. Here is the part of the story that is largely untold. When we talk about global warming pollution, we often do think about technology. We think about wind turbines, solar turbines, hybrid cars, all of those new things out there that we want to see developing very quickly. And, of course, all of these are crucial. But in fact, the fastest and most important measure of all is energy savings. Energy savings that translate directly into cost savings for businesses and consumers alike, for homeowners. Because you start getting more productivity out of less energy, and that means you're a net gain rather than a cost to business. These things are sometimes hard to visualize because often they're hiding in plain sight. It's our refrigerators, our window frames, our lights, the air conditioning system on this building. Do they have air conditioning in San Francisco? I'm not ever sure. Maybe they don't. Take that line out. We find answers by looking where nobody else thought to look. We are creating new energy performance standards and working directly with companies to help them design and build more efficient products. Thanks to standards that we helped write, refrigerators today use a quarter of the electricity that they used 30 years ago. That's an incredibly powerful fact, and we can do that with every appliance and electronic feature that's out there. One of NRDC's true rock stars, and we have many, and many of them are in this room, actually. All NRDC staff, raise your hand. It's probably half of the room. Be sure to talk to them later because they're all incredibly talented. But to get back to Noah, and he's not here. His fingerprints are everywhere. Take the humble soda vending machine, something that you probably don't put too much thought into. But Noah noticed a couple years ago that these vending machines were popping up all over the place, in hospitals, schools, universities, playgrounds, just everywhere. And the amazing thing, and this is hard to imagine too, there's one vending machine for every 100 Americans. There are 3 million vending machines in the United States humming away 24/7 using large amounts of energy. They use 10 times the energy of an average refrigerator, not just to cool the soda, but to keep the lights on and the change machine going 24 hours a day, many hours when people are nowhere near those vending machines. So Noah thought, well, here's a huge opportunity. Let's make those more efficient. And he went to Coke and Pepsi to see if they would join him in this venture. Needless to say, they weren't that interested to work with an environmentalist. But also, and this was the key fact, Coke and Pepsi don't pay the energy bills for where those soda machines are plugged into. Wherever that socket is, it's not their socket, so they didn't really care. So Noah then went to some of the big players who actually are paying those electric bills and asked them, would you like to get together and I can really show you how to save some money, but we have to go to Coke and Pepsi together. They agreed. Coke and Pepsi developed somewhat different attitude, and we started to work together to design new performance standards for soda vending machines. When these new machines are fully phased in, and they're being phased in now, we expect to save, and this is extraordinary, 5 billion kilowatts of energy, 5 billion kilowatt hours of energy a year. I mean, that is a huge amount of energy for something nobody ever even thought of. That's enough to run the refrigerators in 10 million homes across America. That's just one example of Noah's amazing work. He's also been to see the people at Intel, who agreed to tighten up the specifications for their computer chips, a step that will eventually save $1 billion off the nation's energy bills. He's worked with Walmart to help design the performance standards for the compact fluorescent light bulbs that they are selling. He went to China to look at the manufacturers to design the specifications, not only for energy efficiency, but to reduce the amount of mercury in each of these light bulbs by a half. And this is critically important because Walmart has gone out and sold 145 million compact fluorescent light bulbs in the last year. In their own way, they're transforming the market for these light bulbs, but it's critical that the light bulbs actually can deliver the savings and that they're environmentally appropriate, and Noah really contributed to that. He's also worked with manufacturers to tighten performance standards for flat LCD computer models, monitors. And by 2010, EPA estimates that this is going to save $14 billion in electricity costs and keep almost 40 million pounds of carbon dioxide emissions out of the air. Noah Horowitz is one of my personal heroes because he has made such a difference as an individual. And I'm proud to say that NRDC has a staff of 400 people who are making a similar commitment in the various programs that they work in. One person can have an enormous impact. There's another vast untapped resource for energy savings that isn't often thought of, and that's buildings. Offices, factories, hotels, retail stores, our own homes. Buildings are where we consume 40% of our energy and are therefore responsible for a third of the global warming emissions. By using better design and a little extra brain power, we can dramatically cut those numbers, too. People don't often think of cities as being green, but changing these urban landscapes is absolutely critical for us to protect those wild ecosystems that we're so committed to and that underlie a lot of NRDC's work protecting wilderness and wildlife. 50% of the world's population lives in cities, 75% of North America, South America, and Europe do, and most of the growth of the 21st century is going to be in the urban environment. All these cities are going to need better buildings and smarter planning, and they're going to need to retrofit what they have. I live in New York. We have a brand new plan to reduce energy efficiency by 30%, energy consumption by 30%. In order to achieve that, we're going to have to go to our current buildings. We're not going to be building that many buildings. It's an island. It's already all built up. Maybe you know that. To save the ice caps, we're going to need a lot of cement and a lot of steel and a lot of glass, all used the right way. Last December, NRDC elected a new board chair. At first blush, some might think that he was an unlikely choice for an environmental group. Dan Tishman is a fourth-generation leader of the Tishman construction company, one of the nation's major builders. But Dan is no ordinary builder. He started out in college with a degree in wildlife ecology. He started his career at the National Audubon Society. And 20 years ago, when he joined the family business, he made a commitment to move this down a greener pathway. And he has become a pioneering force in propelling green building to the forefront in the real estate and construction industry across the country. A decade ago, Tishman built the first green skyscraper in New York City, right in the heart of Times Square. He applied the same principles of green building in building the first new building at Ground Zero, 7 World Trade Center, the first office tower in New York to win gold LEED certification. Now he's overseeing construction on the Bank of America headquarters in New York, which will be the first LEED Platinum commercial building in the nation. And it's an enormous building with many, many new features that will provide lessons for other buildings as they get built. NRDC has participated at the table in all of these projects, and there's one thing we know for certain. Smart business practices take on a life of their own. Good ideas travel fast. Our job is to actually make them travel faster. As a result, innovations that were new 10 years ago are now part of doing business, and our challenge is to get the next generation of innovations out there and into the marketplace. Some people have asked whether we can afford what they consider to be the luxury of all these new investments now that the capital markets are in turmoil and the economy is uncertain. My answer is that we can't afford not to. In fact, these things, I think, provide an enormous stimulus to the economy. Remember, it's not just about wind farms and solar panels. If we're talking about retrofitting buildings across the country, we're talking about tens of thousands of jobs for architects, engineers, contractors, air conditioner and drywall installers, software designers, and lighting engineers. There's enormous possibility here if we can marshal the forces to move it forward. These are jobs that are made in America and that also strengthen our global competitive prospect as well. They're jobs that can't be shipped offshore, in businesses that pay lasting dividends to the United States economy through increased competitiveness. California is NRDC's second home. We have offices in San Francisco and Los Angeles. We have over 100 staff in the state of California. And these staff work day in and day out to brighten California's environmental future and particularly its energy future. No state has done more to improve energy efficiency than the great state of California, and NRDC has participated in that every step of the way over the last 25 years. Thanks to strong state standards, the average Californian uses 40% less energy than the typical American. And when I'm talking in other states, I always like to say that nobody thinks that Californians' lifestyle is suffering as a result of that. Per capita electricity demand here has remained steady for 30 years, while economic output has boomed. The state's pioneering energy efficiency programs are a model that's being adopted across the world. The energy savings here cost just half of what would be required to build new power plants to generate the same amount of power. That has added $4 billion to the state economy. One reason we've been able to achieve so much in California is support from the business community. Of course, the high-tech and venture capitalists who have come out in support of strong global warming solutions. Mobilizing these communities is why we've partnered with Environmental Entrepreneurs, or E2, based right here in the Bay Area to make sure that this new voice of business is heard in Sacramento and in Washington and beyond that. We've also seen tremendous support from California's utilities, particularly PG&E, who we've recognized with an award for business leadership and excellence. Their leadership has made the California model possible, and they've been strong supporters of global warming emission standards at both the state and increasingly the national level, where they're an important ally. It will come as no surprise to you to learn that the California model is being exported across the world, and we're helping make that happen too. Last year, we opened an office in Beijing specifically to advance the energy efficiency models that have proved so successful right here. Not long ago, we helped arrange a delegation of California energy officials and utility execs to advise the Chinese government on how to meet its own energy and environmental challenges. China's building two giant coal-fired power plants a week, 1,000 megawatts a week, 60,000 megawatts a year, a huge amount of regular toxic air pollutants, as well as global warming emissions. China's system is incredibly inefficient. Our challenge is to improve that efficiency. In the coastal province of Jiangsu, we're working with the Economic Development Administration to design more efficient energy systems, very much based on those that you're experiencing right here. What we're talking about there are what we call energy-efficient power plants, the equivalent amount of energy to building a new power plant. They've invested enough in energy efficiency to avoid 15% of their peak energy demand, which is really significant. And the results there have been so successful that the national leadership is trying to figure out how to make that program work nationally in China, which is a very bold and serious undertaking. China has a long way to go. There's no question about it. I'm sure many of you have been there, and you can see how the economic engine is creating a series of problems on its own. But change is beginning there, and we're part of it. And the efficiency opportunity is really taking hold, and we're committed to making that move forward. Smart investors already understand the clean technology opportunity. Shares in wind and solar companies have been rising, hundreds of millions of dollars in venture capital is flowing into clean tech. On the flip side, many of the leading investment banks, particularly Bank of America, Citi, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Morgan Stanley, have just announced new lending principles called carbon principles to reflect the growing financial risk from investing in highly polluting power plants, particularly coal-fired power plants that release carbon emissions. These polluting facilities will not be cheap anymore. There are more than 150 new coal-fired power plants on the drawing boards today, many of them in search of financing. Those plants, if built, will lock in a tremendous amount of new carbon emissions over the next 60 years timeframe of those plants. In recent months, backers have started to scrap those plant proposals, and there are campaigns literally poised around every new coal-fired power plant in the country. These are not going to move forward. And once the banks start raising issues about this, you can really see that things are beginning to change in the business community. As economists are quick to remind us, there's no such thing as a free lunch. But the menu today is much less expensive and far more appetizing than we've been led to believe in the past. Over the next 20 years, America will spend $3 trillion on energy infrastructure, and we're going to spend it one way or the other. It's our choice on whether to spend it on smart, clean, new technologies that promote efficiency and reduce emissions, or to spend it on the 19th century energy technologies that got us here in the first place. In our view, there is no choice. This story isn't about sacrifice or rolling back the march of human progress. It's actually about marching forward. To do that, we have to be brave and bold, and there is simply no time to think small. And that's just going back to what the scientists are telling us. We have to move very, very quickly. Up until now, a small group of industries, but they're very mighty industries, the coal industry, the oil industry, a number of recalcitrant utilities, have dominated the climate debate in the United States. But this year, many in the business sector, new leaders, are beginning to take charge of the conversation, and we need to promote that. We're beginning to see more and more companies racing to get on the winning side. We need them to be a powerful voice, to consolidate that voice and take it to Washington where we need change. This sometimes feels like a strange position for an environmentalist to be in. to be in linked arm-in-arm in many cases with these corporate execs. But I've really seen the power of Adam Smith's invisible hand move forward. And to us, I think it is just critical that the green thumb is pointed in the right direction, and it's that green thumb where NRDC really puts its attention. The fact of the matter is that industrialization, 19th century technologies got us into this, and it's going to take innovation, business leadership, leadership from all sectors to get us out of it. But we do have to move quickly. If there's one thing that I'd like you to remember from today, it's that we have a very short window of time. Remember Dr. Pachauri, 2012, a very short window of time to begin to get solutions in place for global warming before we see catastrophic impacts across the planet. Impacts that will not only devastate ecosystems, but will affect hundreds of millions of people, many, many poor people who cannot afford to deal with the changes that could be happening. The longer we wait, the more expensive solutions will become. The more quickly potential profit margins will shrink. We are already seeing the effects of global warming. Our children and our grandchildren will have to bear the brunt of what those effects are. This is not a legacy that we can afford, one that I don't want to be part of. We have to take it on ourselves to change it. People often ask me if I'm optimistic about the future, and actually I am. I work with people every day, certainly at NRDC, where that's what we're poised to do, find solutions to the most serious problems affecting the planet. But people also from science, from business, from government, who are determined to get this right. These people do see a path forward. They have solutions. They are the clean technologies, the capital investments, the policies that are necessary. All of these people have a deep commitment to fix this. We need to pool all of that energy to get to the right result. I am propelled every day with the urgency of this critical issue, but I am sustained by the knowledge that there really are solutions out there, that our job is to push the solutions forward. The challenge, of course, is to get them in place in time, and I think that's where everybody can play a role. Certainly we at NRDC have a role, but all of you do too, in whatever business or sector you're in. So I urge you all to join us because the challenge is huge. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Francis Beinecke, President of the Natural Resources Defense Council. I am Kerry Curtis, Chair of the Club's Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Now, we have many audience questions, so let's get to them. First is one that I'll ask.
Okay.
And that is that 3 years ago, in this very room, Adam Werbach, who was formerly the president of the Sierra Club, gave a speech called, Is Environmentalism Dead? And that his speech was, the theme of it wasn't so much that environmentalism is dead, but that the environmental movement should no longer be considered to be the exclusive proprietary territory for environmentalists and non-government organizations. But and clearly, I think your remarks today indicate that solving the climate issue is a challenge for everyone, most especially the business community. But what role is there going forward for environmental groups such as NRDC, Sierra Club, and so forth?
Well, I think one thing that's happened in the last few years, and I think it's very exciting, is that environment really has burst forth again, as it did in 1970 with Earth Day, as an issue of fundamental concern to many, many, many people. It wasn't compartmentalized in the environmental world. Our job as an environmental organization is to raise the bar, to create the challenge for what has to be addressed, and then to really invite everybody into participating in finding the solutions. Not everybody wants to be a member of an environmental organization. We love our members. We want more. But what we really want is engagement across society where everybody takes personal responsibility for their own quality of life, their air, their water, their community. And I think that's happening more and more, and that's good news.
Following up on that, there are several questions from the audience asking you which presidential candidate should we vote for. Now, I know that I can't ask that question because NRDC is a 501c3 organization right here, and you don't want to compromise that status. But what I will ask you is that in the first, let's say we're fast forward to a year from now when we have a new president, what would be the critical elements in the president's, the new president's first 100 days that relate to climate change and environment?
Well, one thing, and I think this is very important, is that of the three leading candidates, the two Democrat and the Republican, all of them have strong positions on climate change. They all have the 80% by 2050 goal, which is very important. They may have different strategies on how to reach it. What has to happen in the first 100 days, if it hasn't happened by then, is that we have to pass this national comprehensive cap on carbon emissions in the United States. Now, we're working very hard as NRDC with the broader environmental community, with the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, to have that completely designed and ready. But we need presidential leadership to do it. And so one is domestic action. The other is international leadership. The United States has been absolutely lagging. I was at the Bali conference, UN conference in December, where there were 187 nations on one side of the issue and the United States really alone on the other. I mean, the United States did join the Bali framework at the end. But we need a president who is not only going to exert domestic leadership, they have to exert international leadership. Because in essence, the framework that the United States adopts will have impact worldwide. So from our point of view, getting the cap and trade program, getting the legislation and the policies right on climate change is absolutely critical to happen in those first 100 days. Then I'll just say there are lots of other things that have happened in the last year that have to, the last 8 years under the Bush administration that have to be reversed. Many of our environmental rules and regulations, many of our protections, particularly for national forests, have been rolled back over the last 8 years. We're working hard to make a list of those and really deliver the top priorities to whoever the president is, whatever party, to make those changes and get us back in a program of environmental protection that we have known historically.
I'd like to address some points that relate to a feeling amongst a lot of concerned citizens in the recent past. One is, don't we have to reduce consumption and shrink the economy and not pretend that growth, economic growth and material growth can continue?
Well, I think, one of the things that we're focusing on, as I mentioned in great detail, is efficiency. There's so many ways we can get more efficiency out of this system, and that's, particularly in the electric sector, but, in the way we use all kinds of resources, paper, whatever we use, water, where we use tremendous amounts of water. Water is going to be the limiting factor of the 21st century, and probably water will be the first place where we really in this country face the impacts of global warming. So there are enormous efficiencies that we can get out of all of the natural resources that we use. That's what drives us. We have to do it. And we are a nation of consumption, and I think we really have to look in every category. It doesn't matter how you rank it. We use more per capita than anybody else in the world. And that has to change because what would the world be if there are 4 billion consumers who consume at our rate? The world, the planet would be devastated, and we can't afford that.
And what is the role, if any, for population growth in terms of future climate issues?
Well, as I mentioned, we're 300 million people. We use resources at a huge rate. Parts of the world that have very growing populations, but their uses of resources per capita are very, very small. So, from our point of view, the focus has to be on getting greater efficiencies out of the system. And I think over the last decade, the estimates on population growth have actually changed quite significantly. Do you remember there was a time when people were projecting 14 billion people on the planet? I think that number has come way down. And as nations develop and particularly develop economic opportunity and education, those numbers begin to shift. So I think that's where the investment needs to be made.
And several audience members want to know what your view is about nuclear energy as a part of the mix going forward.
Well, you know, we have 20% of our energy now comes from nuclear. We have about 103 nuclear plants in the country. We haven't licensed a new plant in over 30 years. All of those plants actually have to be rebuilt just to keep at the 20% number. So, you know, in my view, the big issue we face are the 100-plus new coal-fired power plants that are on the drawing boards. And nuclear, in some ways, is a diversion because I don't see that 20% number dramatically changing. There are huge issues with nuclear. One is the cost. It's never competed with other sources of energy. Two is proliferation, which continues to be a serious issue and even more serious now than it has been in the past. And three is waste. We haven't figured out how to deal with nuclear waste. We can't really, not we, because we won't be doing it, but one can't advance nuclear power until those other issues are really addressed. And as I say, from our point of view, it's the emissions coming from coal where we really have to put our attention first and foremost.
And another question from the audience about biofuels. Please discuss NRDC's support of biofuels in light of recent studies showing the adverse impact of biofuels in the climate change mix.
Well, we're in a period, the nation is, of enormous enthusiasm for biofuels. There's a lot of biofuels boosters out there. The thing about biofuels, and we do think that biofuels, particularly cellulosic biofuels, could play a role in providing fuel for the future for this country. But there are many environmental concerns that are associated with that. And so what we're focusing now on is how to deal with the environmental implications of a very big growth in the biofuel industry. What about pesticides and water and the amount of land and competition with protecting forests and agriculture and areas that have been in conservation for a long time? So the biofuels issue is incredibly complex. There's a lot more research that's being done. And as an environmental advocacy group, our job is to make sure that the environmental implications are fully dealt with. And right now, there's so much enthusiasm in the business and agriculture sector to move it forward that, you know, we have to focus on what the implications are and make sure that they're addressed in any policies that move this forward. So it's there is a role to play, but it really has to be managed, and that's what we're focusing on.
And this audience member wants to know how can we justify oil and gas continuing to receive tens of billions of dollars in subsidies every year, even when they're having their highest profits in the history of capitalism?
That's a good question. How can we?
We shouldn't.
Would the person who answered that or asked that question care to try to answer it?
I'm trying to develop a story that shows the insanity of that situation.
Right, right. Right. That's exactly right. I think that, you know, one of the things that we're very focused on is what are the things that we need to unleash? These are industries that have gotten support from the United States government for decades. They're totally developed, mature industries. They don't need more support from the federal government. This is an area that's sort of getting rid of subsidies where I think the environmental community and you know, those who focus on financial implications can really partner up. I mean, we'd like to see one of the things that we've worked very hard on in the last, through the, you know, various ramifications of the energy bill is to restore the production tax credits for wind power, which are just, approved on an annual basis, which provide no certainty for the investors in that industry that there's any long-term ability to actually move that market forward. We think renewable has a very important role to play, but they need some surety. So why not, if you're going to put government support behind things, why don't we put it behind those new technologies, new solutions that we're trying to make a significant part rather than in the areas that have received subsidies, you know, for time immemorial, as far as I could tell. Yes?
Mm-hmm. And he would have been the 60th vote. He would have been the hero to make it happen. And he was a no-show. He was AWOL. Senator McCain was AWOL on the energy bill vote.
Well, that's good for people to know.
One of the political issues that potentially could get in the way of our doing something about climate change is the measures that have potential to make a difference seem to have an especial burden for the common consumer, the middle class. How can we address the how can we avoid soaking the middle class, so to speak, as we address these issues?
Well, that's why I mentioned earlier, I think that the economic questions are going to be absolutely central to how the issue of climate change gets addressed. And that's where the McKinsey report was very important. There are a number of other studies coming out on this issue. One of the design features of the cap and trade legislation is to create an auction so that the allowances are auctioned off and a fund of money is created, which is actually a very, very substantial fund that can be used to allay some of the additional costs that would be incurred by putting the system in place. And I think there's tremendous focus now on where the economic costs are, who would be experiencing them, and then how do you manage that over time? So it's a very good question, and I don't think that the answers are that clear yet, but I do think it's very important to know that they're definitely on the radar screen, that people are struggling with that every day, that it has to be manageable.
Earlier you spent some time talking about China, and this audience member wants to know, how do we as Americans morally justify giving direction to China regarding CO2 emission when their environmental standards are not so bad and when we are a much bigger polluter?
Well, in global warming emissions, we are historically, because of the amount that we've emitted over time, by far the highest. But China's emissions are growing at a very rapid rate. And as I mentioned, we have an office there. The Chinese are looking seriously at these issues. They developed a policy on global warming in July. They developed a brand new energy plan in December. You know, our role is to provide literally technical information and advice on how to structure some solutions to these issues. But to the questioner's point, the United States bears enormous responsibility here. We need to take steps. We need to be a leader. No other nation, particularly developing nations, whether it's China or India or Brazil or others, are going to take on this issue or change their own practices until we do. So the first responsibility is to us, and that's where we have to focus our attention.
There are quite a few environmental issues that don't relate directly to climate change, and some questions relate to some of those. Mercury abatement and pesticides and electromagnetic radiation, the wireless revolution, and so forth. These are issues that relate to the impact on human health and the health of other species in the environment. How high do those issues collectively rank in NRDC's agenda?
They rank very high. We have six top institutional priorities. Curbing global warming is obviously number one. Moving America beyond oil. Stemming the tide of toxic chemicals is very important. We do have a public health program. Actually, many of the public health folks we have are located here in San Francisco, and we work on some of the biggest issues that we're facing. Diesel pollution has been absolutely central to NRDC. We think it's the biggest polluter in the air that has the most impact on human health. We've had great success in reducing diesel emissions from our trucks and buses. We're now focused on the ports, which is the largest single marine transportation, is one of the largest single emitters of diesel pollution, which is a carcinogen, and we need to address it. We're focused on mercury as well and have had some very good success, particularly internationally, on really identifying what are the sources of mercury and reducing those. I think that public health obviously is an absolutely imperative issue because and there will be public health implications from climate change as well as disease reaches in much broader geographies than they have in the past. So it's one of our top issues, and maybe the Commonwealth Club could invite one of our great public health advocates to talk about that.
All right. Consider it done.
Okay.
And in that same vein, here in California, in the Bay Area specifically, there's a controversy right now around aerial spraying for the apple moth. I know that's a very local issue.
Yeah.
But is there anything in the NRDC agenda or collected wisdom that would address that?
I know about that largely because I've been out here for several days. I've been reading the San Francisco Chronicle, which has been covering it in quite detail. And, you know, I'd have to defer to our public health professionals, particularly Dr. Gina Solomon, who is the expert on that. I don't have the answer myself.
And how about the role of agriculture, food, and basically agriculture and food? There's a big movement, especially in the Bay Area, towards organic food and fresh produce, locally grown produce, vegetarianism, et cetera. And, in fact, I'm planning an event for later in the year on feedlots. And one of the issues is the climate change impact of feedlots and dairies. So, how do you assess those issues? What's the potential for climate change in embracing some improvements in agriculture?
Well, agriculture actually is getting much better known as a major contributor to the global warming problem. And this is an issue that we're beginning to look at. We have a sustainable agriculture program here. You know, I have spent now the last week or so in the Bay Area, and the awareness of sustainable agriculture, the availability of organics, the knowledge and sophistication of people in this area to those issues is way out ahead of certainly what it is in the New York area, or I would venture to say most of the rest of the country. So this is an area that NRDC is taking particular interest in, and I imagine we'll be doing more on. But there, you know, for many years, actually, we've been focusing on feedlots and dairies in California from a water pollution standpoint, and we've had litigation to improve the operations from a water standpoint. But we're really in the investigative stage on how to address these issues from a climate standpoint. And if I was sitting here a year from now, I would promise you I would have more to talk about in that vein.
Excellent. We've reached the time in our program when we have time for just one or two more questions for Frances Beinecke, who's president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. And there are several questions from the audience here about going forward. How can an individual make a difference as a member of NRDC? What can members do with the NRDC to get involved, number one? Another audience member wants to know how to join the ranks of the environmental entrepreneurs. And then more generally, what are the challenges going forward for NRDC itself in terms of organizational issues and so forth?
Well, we welcome everybody to be a member of NRDC, and the easiest way to do that is to go to our website, www.nrdc.org, where you will find an opportunity to join. Environmental Entrepreneurs, a partner of NRDC, is the business community, and one of our staff, Jen Alley, in the background, if she's waving her hand, it would be happy to provide you for more information on that. As an individual, I think, of course, joining an environmental group, joining NRDC, you know, I think at this point, everybody is their own ambassador on these issues. Everyone needs to take personal action, and we on our website are providing more and more information on how people can do that. I think one of the things that really has been transformative in the last half dozen years is now we actually have lots of things that people can do. You know, 10 years ago in this business, there just weren't that many choices, options for the individual. Now there are so many in your own, you know, taking public transportation, in your buying practices, what you could do to retrofit your own home. And I think one of the important things is to tell those stories widely, because it's not only your action, it's actions of everybody compiled together to show really how the planet can be improved. And in my examples of NOAA, just the simple vending machines or the computer monitors or, you know, when we're buying 145 million compact fluorescent light bulbs and how many power plants that saves over time. The individual action really matters because they add up. And that's a story that we need to tell more and more. Thank you.
Our thanks to Frances Beinecke for her comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 104th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.